Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Save big money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now. Save big money at
Menards. Mary Ann C. McDonough is the author of 8 Steps to Getting Real with Cancer. Kirkus's reviewer calls the debut guide a personal, conversational, and positive perspective on handling the ups and downs of cancer treatment and survival. This week, her new book, Beating Cancer One Truth at a Time, is being released. In this sponsored interview, we talk with Mary Ann about 8 steps. Mary Ann, welcome to Fully Booked.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
You are a journalist and cancer survivor. What are the first 2 steps to getting real with cancer?
First one is actually when you get your diagnosis, you're so shocked that you actually need to pick yourself up and understand what you're battling and where you're going and get some things straight in your head. And that's really hard. It comes from the inside out. And to do that takes a lot of courage and some forethought. You have a little bit of time because you get the diagnosis and you might have a day or two, or in my case, it was 5 days. But in any case, in both books, I talk about being sure that you understand what cancer is and how you feel about it and what you believe about it in yourself, in your body, and in your life. And that's the starting point.
What are a few other tips you give cancer patients in 8 steps?
In 8 steps, I talk about sharing your journey. It's important to share your journey. I don't think it's a going it alone kind of disease. Sometimes in my life, I have done some things alone and opted to do that, and that's just human sometimes. But I don't believe you can do that effectively with cancer because it's just too hard. It's too hard. There's so much involved, so much information, and that I believe it's really important that you take some time to figure out how you're going to include your family and other supporters who are standing at your side. And I wrote that 8 steps for both the patient and the families because the families hurt too. They just kind of need to know also how they can come alongside without intruding.
What inspired you to write a second book about cancer?
My oncologist, actually. She thought that the way I went about the first book would be really helpful in support groups for discussion. And that's because I talk about a patient's being proactive and being very aware of what they believe. I cover myths, especially cultural myths that we have around cancer that I believe are deleterious to not only the patient, but also the families. And our society as a whole has some very wrong ideas about cancer, such as once you get it, that's what you're going to die from. You'll never be whole again. You'll never really be healthy again. And so I think it's important that you discuss these things.
Mary Ann, thanks for talking to us about 8 steps. If you're just joining the podcast, you can order Mary Ann C. McDonough's 8 Steps to Getting Real with Cancer at Amazon.com, LightningSource.com, and BarnesandNoble.com.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Clay Smith. I'm the editor of Kirkus Reviews.
And I'm Megan Labrice. I'm the staff writer, and welcome to a very special episode of Fully Booked, sponsored by Penguin Young Readers Group, one of the premier publishers of children's literature in the United States. Clay, they have a new imprint coming.
Yeah.
They'll have the first books in summer 2019. The name of the imprint is Kokila. And it's a Sanskrit name for the koel bird, whose song is thought to herald new beginnings, especially the monsoon.
Yeah.
And I had the pleasure of speaking with Vice President and publisher Namrata Tripathi for a feature in this issue of the magazine. And what they're doing at this imprint is really bold, new, and cool.
You mentioned in your article how they're looking for marginalized voices and sort of seeking diversity in everything they do. But it was also interesting that, you know, with this whole idea of new beginnings and the name of the imprint, that they're sort of rethinking how a publishing company works.
Yeah, everything from the way they run their meetings, you know, it's all women of color in the office. They accept unrepresented manuscripts 4 months a year, which is something that many major publishers do not do.
Yeah.
And really, like, it's really pushing beyond, like, the tokenism of, like, oh, here's a story, you know, with a traditionally marginalized character in it, and we accept it for that. It's like, we want to tell lots of diverse stories, good stories. We want to have conversations about them. You know, we want to represent all types and shapes and places and everything. It's going to be really good.
Yeah. No, it seems like a ton of great energy there. So thank you to them for sponsoring this episode of the podcast.
And I'll tell you, that was one of my best interviews this year.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I think
so. Nice. Well, this is a lot coming from you. You've done many, many, many. For those of you who don't get the print issue, Megan is our main reporter who interviews writers and publishing people. So that is saying a lot.
And if you're a writer, I'd like to interview you.
Yeah. Not so fast. So Megan and I were on stage recently at the Texas Book Festival in Austin. It happened on the weekend of October 27th and 28th. And a few days before that, on October 25th, we gave away the 2018 Kirkus Prize. The categories are fiction, nonfiction, and young readers literature. And the three winners, and actually this year there's four, because in young readers, they're a picture book won, and obviously it has an author and an illustrator. But each of those people won $50,000, except for the author and illustrator. They each received $25,000. And we asked them and the finalist of the prize to stay in Austin a few days for the Texas Book Festival. And we did a panel there where an astounding 11 of the 18 finalists were on stage. And there was a huge crowd in the Kirkus Reviews tent at that very well-run festival.
And it actually, for having that many authors on a panel, it went impossibly well.
Yeah.
I would say.
Nobody hogged the mic. It was great.
And just for the record, before we go on and introduce this, those three winners in those three categories were Ling Ma for Severance in fiction, Rebecca Solnit for Call Them By Their True Names, American Crises and Essays in nonfiction, and Derek Barnes and illustrator Gordon C. James for Crown and Ode to the Fresh Cut in Children's Literature. So that was cool. And Ling Ma was actually able to join us for the panel.
That's right. So it's maybe not the typical panel you would hear at a book festival, where there's usually two or three writers talking about one specific idea. I mean, the beauty of the Kirkus Prize is that it, you know, extends from picture books all the way to, you know, say, literary fiction for adults. And so we just asked each of the 11 finalists who were there to talk a little bit about sort of the inspiration for their books you know, how they came to write it. Megan and I introduced each of the writers, so you'll be able to tell easily during this podcast who is talking. And then there's some great questions from the audience. And we hope you enjoy this panel.
The feedback I heard the most on site from audience members was, I want to read all these books.
Yeah. So, well, that's 18 excellent books. And then after that trial, that person can become a Kirkus critic.
Not so fast.
Yeah, that runs both ways. All right, let's play the panel.
Okay, so out of 1,193 books, we picked six in each category. So these are all good books.
They're really great books. And we could spend, you know, an hour on each one of these 11 writers talking about their books, but we're not going to. So I've asked them each to talk about their books in 6 words or less. Flash fiction. No, just kidding. So Ling, why don't we start with you? Ling Ma, at our corner over here, was born in Sanming, China, and grew up in Utah, Nebraska, and Kansas. She attended the University of Chicago and received an MFA from Cornell University. Prior to graduate school, she worked as a journalist and editor. Her writing has appeared in Granta, Vice, Playboy, Chicago Reader, Ninth Letter, and other publications. A Chapter of Severance, which actually won the 2018 Kirkus Prize for Fiction, received... Yeah. Received the 2015 Grey Wolf SLS Prize. So, Ling, tell us a little bit about the inspiration for the novel, how it came to you.
In 6 words or less?
Yeah. Oh, you can have 7.
I can do it in 4. Bibles made in China. I was working at a company, and that was downsizing and closing down their Chicago office. And it was a very sort of slow, grueling process of a lot of sort of rumors and whispers, and no one knew what was going on. And I also was laid off, and watching sort of the waves of layoffs, especially people who had been there for like 30 years working at the company, I really started meditating about work and the nature of work. And I was also thinking about a previous job I had held, which was coordinating the manufacture of Bibles in China. And so those two things kind of came together for me as I worked on it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Up next, we have Katie Williams. And Katie Williams is the author of the novel Tell the Machine Goodnight, a 2018 Kirkus Prize finalist, and the young adult novels Absent and The Space Between Trees. Her writing has appeared in The Atlantic, Best American Fantasy, American Short Fiction, Plowshares, Subtropics, and elsewhere. She earned her MFA from the Michener Center for Writers at the University of Texas, right here in scenic Austin. Katie, if you would please.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming today. My book is called Tell the Machine Goodnight, and it takes place in a near future San Francisco, 2035. And it's about people who work for a company that has invented a technology to predict personal happiness. So the story centers around a mother who works for the company. She works as a contentment technician, so she gives the tests that give people their little list of the things that will make them happy. And then her son, her teenage son, who struggles with an eating disorder. And I lived in San Francisco for many years and watched tech come into the city and change the city. And are we telling about how we got the idea for the book? Is that?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So that really informed the book. And then also, I just write a lot from image. So I will put 3 images together and then kind of weave them into a story or a novel. And so I had... an image of a person with a severed finger, which is one of the first recommendations a person gets in the book. To cut off their finger will make them happier. And then I had an image of someone who is making little models of extinct animals, which is what the machine tells my main character will make her happier. And then the third part was just, what if there was a machine that could predict happiness and someone who worked for that machine who had someone in their life that was fundamentally unhappy. And the novel grew from there.
If people visit you in the book signing tent, will you tell them what will make them happy?
I will, I promise. It'll work.
Okay, up next we have Sarah Smarsh. Hello. Journalist Sarah Smarsh has covered socioeconomic, class, politics, and public policy for The Guardian, The New York Times, The Texas Observer, Pacific Standard, and many others. A native of rural Kansas, Smarsh is a frequent speaker and commentator on economic inequality and the news media. Her book, Heartland, is a finalist for the 2018 Kirkus Prize and a 2018 National Book Award finalist as well. Would you please tell us a little bit about Heartland?
Yes. Well, first let me say I'm so happy to be in Austin. I actually, the last couple of years of the writing process of Heartland were spent here. I needed a little bit of distance from my home state, Kansas, where I have very intentionally remained most of my adult life. And Austin always feels like home to me. So thanks for being here. So Heartland is a book that I actually knew, believe it or not, that I was going to write when I was a child. I used to tell my family, I'm going to write a book about you someday. And it couldn't have been a more unlikely claim for a kid where I'm from, because I was raised in a farmhouse by grandparents who left school in sixth and ninth grade, respectively. So not only am I the first from my family to finish college, but to finish high school, in fact. And but I was a so I knew that I wanted to I knew I had some stories to tell somehow, but of course at that age I didn't know why that might matter and how to articulate them. My story is very much about rural America, about the class divides of this country, which of course intersects with all sorts of aspects of American identity, which I try to be reverent to in the book. And I've been working as a journalist for almost 20 years, so that gave me the language to articulate what I sensed as a child and as a first-generation college student, which is that we are a woefully inequitable society in economic and so many other terms, and I just tried to contribute my family's story to that conversation.
Next, we've got Nafisa Thompson-Spires, who earned a PhD in English from Vanderbilt University and an MFA in creative writing at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Her work has appeared or is forthcoming in Sweet McSweeney's The Organist, The Paris Review Daily, Dissent, and BuzzFeed Books, among others. Her debut story collection, Heads of the Colored People, is a 2018 Kirkus Prize finalist and is on the fiction long list for the National Book Award.
For coming. My book, Heads of the Colored People, deals with Black middle-class life in this current era, kind of spans from 1991 to now. And all of the stories are dark and satirical in some way. The characters range from cosplayers, Black cosplayers, to people who are doing ASMR videos on YouTube, to girls who are the only Black girl in their entire white private school. So I was trying to think about what it means to be Black in this contemporary era, especially when so many people are arguing that we're post-racial, which is obviously not true. And so a lot of the stories, again, kind of poke fun at the idea of post-racial or the fact that we could ever get there. And the title of my book comes from a series of literary sketches by James Bethune Smith, who's a Black abolitionist and poet, and his original book was called The Heads of the Colored People Done with a Whitewash Brush. And I was initially trying to update his sketches and write directly back to his, and they were kind of like mine, dark and macabre. But I found that too restrictive, so I basically just stole his title and ran with it and thought about heads more generally. Heads is in psychology, leadership, there's a literal head injury in one of the stories, all that kind of stuff.
All right, just below Nafisa is Meg Medina. She is the author of the YA novels Burn, Baby, Burn, a 2016 Kirkus Prize finalist. Jackie Delgado Wants to Kick Your Ass, winner of the Pura Belpre Author Award, and The Girl Who Could Silence the Wind. She also wrote the picture books Mango, Abuela, and Me, a Pura Belpre Illustrator Award honor book, and Tia Issa Wants a Car, recipient of an Ezra Jack Keats New Writer Award. Medina's latest book, Mercy Suarez Changes Gears, is a finalist for the 2018 Kirkus Prize.
So for Mercy Suarez Changes Gears, I am writing a middle grade novel set in South Florida, in West Palm Beach. Three little pink houses called Las Casitas, where Mercy Suarez, age 11, lives with her father, her mother, and her genius brother, Rolly. Next door, Abuela and Lolo, her favorite grandfather. And on the other side, Tia Inés and the psycho five-year-old twins who are her cousins. This is a book about change at its heart. It's about the changes that happen to girls when they're in the sixth grade, when one minute they are playing with all their friends, boys and girls together, and the next minute someone says something horrible like, "I think he likes you." This is a novel about change at 11 and a change at 80. because her family's been keeping a secret from her about her grandfather. And when Mercy discovers that secret, she's enraged. So what I want people to know is that the most joy I had was writing a functioning, happy Latino family that was struggling with something hard. I fell in love with Mercy's voice, with all of those Suarez people, and I hope that your kids will too.
Thank you, Meg. Two Megs left. We have Beth Macy. Beth is a journalist who writes about outsiders and underdogs. Her writing has won more than a dozen national journalism awards, including a Nieman Fellowship for Journalism at Harvard and the 2013 J. Anthony Lucas Word in Progress Award for Factory Man, How One Furniture Maker Battled Offshoring, Stayed Local, and Helped Save an American Town. Her latest book, Dope Sick, is a finalist for the 2018 Kirkus Prize, and her previous book, True Vine, was a finalist back in 2016. Beth, please tell us about the new one.
Thanks so much. I've been a journalist. I'm kind of a unicorn in the world of journalism. I've reported from the same place in Roanoke, Virginia for 3 decades. And this book about the opioid crisis, like my other two books, grew out of reporting I initially did for the newspaper. I started writing about heroin when it landed in our wealthy suburbs around the city where I live in 2012. And readers sort of spit out their coffee after reading this 3-part series and went, what? Wealthy white kids are doing heroin? So when I proposed to do this book, I was worried that because I've had addiction in my family my whole life, that I would get depressed. And a friend of mine said, because you can never go wrong, quoting Mr. Rogers, said, find the helpers. So I wrote this story, which traverses the arc of the epidemic from its beginning with OxyContin in the 1990s in rural America to cities and suburbs and to more recently farm towns by people like activist doctors and mothers who have lost their children and ATF agents who are going the extra mile. I'm trying to show how we got here and where the gaps are, because there are so many gaps for people struggling. We have 4 million people addicted to opioid that have opioid use disorder, and only 1 in 10 getting treatment. We are basically leaving it to the institution of the American family to deal with the worst drug epidemic in the history of our nation. And my hope is that this book will mobilize you to care. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Beth. From Beth to another reporter, Shane Bauer. Is a senior reporter for Mother Jones. He is the recipient of the National Magazine Award for Best Reporting, Harvard's Goldsmith Prize for Investigative Reporting, Atlantic Media's Michael Kelly Award, and the Hillman Prize for Magazine Journalism, among others. He is also the co-author, along with Sarah Shord and Joshua Fatal, of a memoir, A Sliver of Light, which details his time spent as a prisoner in Iran. His new book, American Prison, is a 2018 Kirkus Prize finalist.
So I had started my career as journalist in the Middle East. I lived in Syria and was in 2009 detained on the Iran-Iraq border, which led to 2 years in prison in Iran's central prison. And when I got out, I found myself getting drawn to American prisons. We have the largest prison system in the world by far. 25% of the world's prisoners are here in this country. And in spending a few years reporting on prisons, was constantly getting frustrated how difficult it was to get inside. So I had the idea of applying for a job as a prison guard in a private prison run by the Corrections Corporation of America. It was extremely easy to get the job. The job was $9 an hour. So I moved to Louisiana, worked in a prison, and happened to be there at a time that it was utterly falling apart. And, you know, saw a system that, you know, just was geared entirely towards making money from captive human lives. So my book details that experience. It also goes into the history of for-profit prisons. Prisons really from the beginning of their creation around the American Revolution were intended to make a profit, and the modern-day prison system grew out of the for-profit prism of slavery. And the man who founded the company I write about actually cut his teeth in the business of prison by running a plantation in Texas, a prison plantation that was the size of Manhattan, where prisoners were forced to pick cotton. And he lived in a plantation home and had prisoners serving him and his family.
Thank you, Sean. Eduardo Halfon is next. Named one of the best young Latin American writers by the Hay Festival of Bogota, Eduardo Halfon is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, Robert Caillois Prize, and Jose Maria de Pereda Prize for the short novel. He is the author of 14 books published in Spanish and 3 novels published in English, including his latest, Morning, which is a 2018 Kirkus Prize finalist. Halfon is currently a visiting professor in creative writing at the University of Iowa. Would you please tell us about the novel?
Hi. Hola. I'm going to do it in Spanish. That's okay. I write in Spanish. Let's just preface it that way. I only write in Spanish, so this is a translation. It's my third book to be translated by somebody else. I don't do the translation. I'm next to them, but I don't do it. Mourning, duelo in Spanish, which is a much bigger word than mourning. Duelo in Spanish has 3 meanings at least, and that's lost in the translation. They had to pick one of the 3, and they chose mourning. I didn't agree, but it's okay. I was in Guatemala in 2015, where I was born. I was born in Guatemala, grew up there, and then left for the States when I was 10. That's why my English is like this. I was back in Guatemala with my father, having a glass of wine, and I asked him about the death of his brother, his oldest brother, who had died when he was 5, who had drowned in a lake in Guatemala. And he spoke a little bit about it, and at the end he said, "But please don't write this." I said, "Of course not." And the first thing I did the following morning was write what turned out to be the first line. Se llamaba Salomón. His name was Solomon. I had no idea where that was going. I usually start with a very concrete image like you. Concrete, I mean, from my life, very intimate. But then the book takes me somewhere else. And this is a short novel about that little boy who, needless to say, did not drown, as I was told as a kid. So I find out slowly what really happened to him. But it's also a book about Guatemala, about identity, about my grandparents. It's a very hard book to define in 3 minutes, Clay. Thank you very much.
It was a good job.
We're going to take a short break now, so feel free to indulge in your favorite flavor of soda water. Come back. There will be several more Kirkus Prize finalists on the second half of this special episode of Fully Booked.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
Andrew Diamond's novel Impala won the 24th Annual Writer's Digest Award for genre fiction and the Reader's Favorite Gold Medal for Mystery. Amazon.com editors picked it as the best mystery thriller of the month in September 2016. Our reviewer calls his most recent mystery, Gate 76, a consummate thriller with some of the best characterization you'll see all year. In this sponsored interview, we talk with Andrew about his book. Andrew, welcome to Fully Booked.
Thank you.
So your lead, Freddie Ferguson, has a down-on-his-luck comic appeal. He says at one point, "I get premonitions. I'm out of town on a job, and I check my watch, and I don't know, just the way it says 12:33, I know my apartment's on fire." What goes into creating a great character?
I think he has to have a balance. You know, Freddie can be serious at times, and sometimes his view of the world is a little bit dark, but it's hard for anyone to get by in the world with too dark of a worldview. So he has some humor to him, too. Mm-hmm. And he has a past, a bit of a troubled past. And he's also perceptive, and he cares about what's going on around him. Mm-hmm. So if you take a mix like that in any person, in any position in the world, they become fairly interesting.
Right. And so he was a boxer and then he becomes a PI. Why that career trajectory?
I guess I wanted someone who was a little street smart and a little tough. Mm-hmm. And he has a bit of a temper sometimes. He's a fairly passionate person. And he, after his boxing career goes south, he wants to do some good in the world. He wants to become a cop, but he notes that he doesn't quite have the temperament for that job. Mm-hmm. And he gets lucky in meeting someone who is willing to give him a chance as a detective. And from there, you know, he is able to do some good in the world.
Right. So Gate 76 starts with a woman at an airport who's obviously fleeing from someone. What made you interested in telling her story?
I had a friend when I was younger who became a sex worker, and her story didn't turn out well. Part of me always had wanted to save her.
Right.
And she never really left my mind.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you wanted to try to provide a different ending? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in a way I did. I mean, yeah. I heard Carl Hyacin talk once about why he writes fiction. And he said part of the reason is that as a reporter, a lot of the stories that he covered, the way things turn out in the real world really aren't that good.
And right.
When you write fiction, you get a chance to make it turn out the way you want sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andrew, thanks so much for talking with us about your book. If you're just joining the podcast, you can find Gate 76 at online retailers and by request at your local bookstore.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
Next, we have Naima Koster. She is a native of Fort Greene, Brooklyn. She holds an MFA in fiction from Columbia University, an MA in English and creative writing from Fordham, and a BA in English and African American Studies from Yale. Her stories and essays have appeared in the New York Times, Guernica, Arts and Letters, Quelle, and The Rumpus. Koster is the recipient of numerous awards and a Pushcart Prize nomination, Halsey Street, a 2018 Kirkus Prize finalist for fiction, is her first novel. Please tell us about the book.
Hi, everyone. I got the idea for Halsey Street when I was in my early 20s and came back from college to Brooklyn and found myself in this strange in-between space between the old Brooklyn that I knew and the gentrified New Brooklyn that I found. And I found myself with access to both of them because I grew up in Brooklyn and my family was from there. I felt connected to the Brooklyn that I knew, which was black and brown, immigrant, working in middle class. But because I had gone away to these institutions, I also knew what I liked to order in a coffee shop and had my way around the New Brooklyn as well. So I wanted to write a book about a character stuck in this in-between space, but I knew that the novel had to include more than that. And the only hurt of gentrification isn't just being stuck in between. It's also erasure and losing your home, losing your livelihood, being the new family that moves into the neighborhood and isn't sure of how to interact with neighbors. And so I invented the character of Penelope Grand, who returns to Brooklyn and chooses not to live in the house that she grew up in because of a difficult family past that haunts her. And instead, she rents a room in the attic of a new Brooklyn family, a white affluent family, the Harpers. And she becomes enmeshed in their life as she's taking care of her father, Ralph, who's lost his record store and sort of lost his reason for living. And as we follow Penelope move back and forth between these two houses, we learn why she left Brooklyn in the first place. And it has to do with her mother, Mireya, and the ways that her mother hurt her. And so it's a book about a neighborhood and the families that live within it, and also about two women and their journey back to one another.
Thank you.
Just behind Naima is Kiese Lehman. He is the author of the award-winning novel Long Division and a collection of essays, How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America. His latest book, Heavy, an American Memoir, is a 2018 Kirkus Prize finalist.
Hey, how y'all doing? So my mother had me when she was a 19-year-old sophomore at Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi. And a year after she had me, she like fast-tracked her way out of Jackson State into graduate school at Wisconsin. And when I got to be too much, she would send me to my grandmother's house in Forest, Mississippi. And I would just go back and forth, back and forth. One of the things my mother used to discipline me was white canonical authors. So whenever I did things that she thought were wrong, she would throw some Faulkner or Tale of Two Cities or Silas Mariner at me and ship me to my grandmama. And when my grandmama thought I was doing something wrong, she would whip me and or make me read the Bible. And when I was 12 years old, I saw and heard two of my friends get sexually assaulted. And I didn't know what to do with that, especially because I was experiencing sexual violence in my house. So I tried to have a conversation with my mom. It didn't work. She sent me to my grandmother's house. I asked my grandmother if I could try to write to her about what I was feeling. And I wrote down what I thought, what I felt, what I experienced in that previous week, and gave it to my grandmother, who at that time was the most perfect person in my world. She didn't know what to do with it because she herself was dealing with racial terror and sexual violence as well. 30 years later, after writing a book called Long Division, an essay book called How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America, I had the courage to go back and revisit that experience. And I wrote a book called Heavy, an American Memoir, directly to my mother about that experience and about the lies that we tell each other and we told each other in an attempt to protect one another. And so the book is about sexual violence, it's about racial terror, but it's also about the ways that books in some ways shielded us from real conversations and also encouraged other conversations. So I hope y'all check it out.
Thank you. And we've got Tomi Adeyemi. She is a Nigerian-American writer and creative writing coach based in San Diego. After graduating from Harvard University with an honors degree in English literature, she studied West African mythology and culture in Salvador, Brazil. She's the author of Children of Blood and Bone, a 2018 Kirkus Prize finalist.
Hey, guys. It's funny, you never know what you're going to learn at a book festival, and I'm like, oh, my kids are definitely going to have to read A Tale of Two Cities when they do something bad. And they're going to be like, Mom, I hate this. I'll be like, I know. So, but hi, guys. My name is Tomi Adeyemi, and my book is called Children of Blood and Bone, and I pitch it, well, I guess the quickest way to talk about it is when I had the first seed of the idea. I was in a gift shop in Brazil and I saw the Orisha for the first time and it was pictures of them. So I didn't know what they were called. I didn't know what they were about, but I saw it and I was like, oh my God, this is African, The Last Airbender. And if you're a nerd like me, then you can already see it. But for me, it was, I never knew that we had black gods and goddesses beforehand. You don't realize how much you're erased from and how much is taken from you when you have to assume that the only gods out there are like Zeus and Poseidon. So it was a really special experience in this random gift shop to see this poster of Oya and be like, wow, who is this beautiful black goddess with skin that's darker than mine, who's clearly powerful, who's clearly magical, who's clearly sacred. And it unlocked my imagination. And so the book, now I pitch it as Black Panther with magic because it's about a girl fighting to bring magic back to her people and it features this magic, but we also have giant lions, we have like crazy jungles, you know, we have this big adventure, but it's also about what it means to be black in America today. And so even though they're going through these big adventures and they're fighting these crazy battles, they're dealing with metaphors for police brutality, for colorism, for the emotional PTSD that I think a lot of people of color are living with today. Because when you walk by and you're walking to the Texas Book Festival and you see a police car parking on the side, you're not like, oh, hey, you're just like, oh, am I gonna die? No? Okay, let me find this panel. And that's the daily reality that a lot of people are living with. So I wanted to write this adventure that people enjoyed reading, because I hated reading books that were supposed to teach me something, but were boring. I don't think you have to have a boring book to learn something. So I wanted something that was fun and exciting and that you ripped through, but that also that taught you and made you feel. So yeah, I'm excited about the book, and Fox is making it into a movie. So if you really like to learn what happens before the movie, then you can check it out.
All right. Thank you, all of you all. So we actually do have time for some questions. I'm sorry that we stole the audience's microphone for our own panelists. Actually, let's keep it there. Because audience interaction is such an important part of a great book festival like this one. So if we can't hear you, just ask your question, and I will. If we can't hear your question, we will repeat it for you. Who has a question? Sarah, right here. Yeah, she can't wait to read every single book. She'll be like a Kirkus critic. Maybe we should hire you at Kirkus Reviews.
Clay and I will carry, if you get all of the books, we will carry them to your car.
Who else has a question? All right, over here in the corner. She just was asking Eduardo if he's happy with the translation of Mourning and if there are things in the translation that he felt were lost.
Yeah, there's always things that are lost. In English, I have the advantage of being able to receive from my translators their first draft, and to their pity, because they would prefer a dead author. You know? I get too involved. So what you guys would read really is a new version. It's not a translation. I will change things. I will say, no, that's not what was in my head. Because when I'm writing in Spanish, I'm really thinking in English. English became my stronger language. But the words, for some reason, just when I started in Spanish. So when I get their translation and I read something, I say, no, that's not what was in my head. So I'll start changing it. And they said, no, but that's what you wrote. So there's a lot there's a dance that goes on between the translators and myself. But there's always things that are lost, beginning with the title. You know? The title, to me, is the best example of that. Duelo, in Spanish, means mourning. It means luto. No, so it does mean mourning, but it also means duel, combat. And the book is about the relationship between brothers. It's a book about my father and his brother, my brother and I, my grandfathers and their brothers. So it's a book about two brothers, and that's lost. And the third meaning is pain. Yo duelo, I hurt. So there was not really one word, there hasn't been in any language, one word that does that. We haven't found it.
Yeah, yes, if I could talk about the inspiration for the strong female characters. And not to throw shade, but I always find this question interesting because I don't know weak females. So it's like, I learned from, I'm not even saying, it's true. It's like, I really don't, and I learned yesterday that chai tea is just saying TT, and that's what I, like, feel when someone says, like, strong female. I'm like, that's just female. And if you, especially, I mean, it's easy now to just turn on the news and see the incredible battles that women of all ages are fighting, but again, because I don't know any different, I didn't have a choice. It's not a conscious, like, and I don't mean this in a pretentious way, like, I could never write a weak female character, but I'm like, I'm literally trying to break it down in my mind, and I don't think it would be possible. But what I do try and do is with my main character, I kind of cheated because I just used how I think and feel. She's way more eloquent than me, but it's really just writing the fantasy version of myself. So with the other female characters, it's about, I think the most beautiful thing about female strength is it comes in so many different ways. And I think it's very important not just to show the ba 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 ba, look, I'm the only female in the room and all the men are on the floor, even though that's very gratifying. I think it's about finding the spectrum of strength. And so I try and do that with all of my, especially with my female characters, and be like, okay, I know that you're all strong. I know that you're all badasses, but how do I show the nuances in that? And how do I show all the different ways that we as females have to fight? And yeah, it's a complicated thing because the book is about being Black, but because there's also so much about being a female in this world, I felt the need to comment on both. So I'm always sort of interested when I go back and look in and see how they sort of, I guess the intersectionalism within it, if that makes sense. And thank you.
Thank you. Over there?
Thanks so much. I appreciate that. Yeah, even though we're in the middle of the worst public health crisis in our history, surgeons are still prescribing roughly 50% more meds than people actually need to take. And that's, you know, if you have these leftover meds in your medicine cabinets, I mean, one of the characters in my book, once he gets hooked, he takes a job at a senior moving company for the express purpose of stealing people's medications. So safely dispose of them. You know, I have a surgeon friend and I say, why do you prescribe so many? And it's basically, well, if we prescribe not enough, we don't want to be bothered on the weekends. Sorry, doctors, you helped us get into this mess. You need to help us get out. And one of the things that they also need to do is to become waiver to become addiction specialists and provide the medication that study after study says is the best way to prevent overdose and relapse and criminal behavior. But thank you for that comment.
I got a follow-up. So what is a safe way to dispose of them?
A lot of sheriff's departments, you can return them to there. There are drug take-back days, local prevention council. Usually we'll have them online. But a lot of drugstores now have take-back centers. And there's also these bags that you can get called Deterra. And if you put your leftover meds and you just shake it up, then they're safe to dispose of in the trash. They won't hurt the water supply.
Thanks. Question in the back? Yeah. I think your question was writing fiction versus memoir and whether the two blend together in the process. Is there a common truth that's running between the two?
Yeah, that's a great question. Somebody up here can probably answer it, but I'm not sure. After writing this memoir, I'm not sure what truth actually is. I know what an honest reckoning looks like. And I know when I wrote my first two books, I was obsessed with like trying to write the truth. But when I did this book and I wrote it directly addressed to my mom and talked to my mother and my grandmother about stories that we both experienced and we all would use different assemblages of words to talk about the same thing, I just understood that, like, you know, I'm not trying to do that Trump thing where, like, what is truth? But I do know that I think both fiction and nonfiction that I want to create necessitate an attempt at honestly reckoning with what I want to lie about. And what I wanted to lie about in Heavy American Memoir was I wanted to lie about my relationship with my mother, I wanted to lie about my relationship with my grandmother, and I wanted to lie about my relationship to food and weight. And I really wanted to believe that if I got lighter, I would be freer. And when I finished the book, I realized that, like, I needed to be more connected. Like, in order to wake up in the morning, I need to be heavier, not necessarily freer. I'm not sure what that has to do with food. I'm not sure what that has to do with appetite. So for me, I'm trying as a writer to get away from the idea of an essential truth and move, like, soulfully into the idea of honest reckoning.
Okay, over here. Well, it helps to have a mother who wears an Edgar Allan Poe t-shirt. So.
Well, I would say you're already so far ahead of probably everyone on this, not just because of your age, but because you already know you're a writer and you're claiming. I know for me, I ran away from writing for a long time and I didn't tell anyone I did it until like around 21. And so when the book deal came, people were like, what? And I'm like, yes, I've been doing this alone in my room for decades. So the fact that you're here at this big book festival, standing proudly, saying you're a writer, like, you're already killing it. You know it inside. So just keep going because you're telling the world. So it's going to happen. You're going to be sitting up here. It's amazing.
We've got time for probably one more question. One more right here.
Yeah. Without giving spoilers, I'll address it. So she asked specifically about one character. My book has three point of views, but the thing is all of them in a different way struggle with the same thing, and that's living in a world that teaches you to hate what makes you beautiful. So whether that hatred is coming from your own family, whether that hatred is coming from society, whether that hatred is coming from just seeing the pain and injustice you suffer because you're different, you know, everyone in some way, shape, or form has to reckon with that, and they have to challenge that. And the whole sort of theme and message of the book, which I think is true in life, is once you realize that it's a lie and that the thing that they said makes you ugly or unwanted or undeserving of just basic rights and loves isn't true, and that difference makes you magical. With books, you can use metaphors, so it literally makes them magical. But I think once they realize that, there's a certain freedom. But it's not an easy journey, and it's not a straight journey. I think in our society, everyone's always like, self-love, self-care, self-this. And you can be in the morning and be like, yes, and then 2 hours later, you're like, I suck, everything sucks, I should go away. and I feel like that's really how the world works. So I feel like it's important to show people in that battle, and in that battle to love themselves, and it's important to show the wins, but it's also important to show the losses. And the good thing about having three books is it's a journey. I think, like, just like in life, everything is a journey. It's a part of a moment. It's just one chapter. But yeah, so I really wanted to explore that in as many ways as I could. So, yeah. And you're magical. Well, I hope that's why you're emotional, because you know you're magical, and your eyeshadow is popping, and I really like it.
Well, I hope you all will meet our writers in the signing tent around the corner, because these really are some of the best writers in America writing today. And thank you all for being here.
All right, so that was the 2018 Kirkus Prize panel. Thanks for listening. We hope you join us next week. We're going to be talking to Jonathan Lethem. You might remember his novels, The Fortress of Solitude or Motherless Brooklyn. Very New York set novels. He has moved to the West Coast. He teaches at Pomona College now, and his new detective novel is titled The Feral Detective, and it's a really great, fun read, and it's also very insightful. So we hope you join us next week. Until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book. Hopefully one of the 18 books by the 2018 Kirkus Prize finalist.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
N.K. Parton's debut historical novel, Red Tears, reexamines the 1813 Fort Mims massacre in the Mississippi Territory. A major set up the Mississippi militia on the plantation of Samuel Mims to confront Creek Red Stick warriors. Kirkus's reviewer calls the novel an invigorating new account of an American tragedy treated coarsely in history books. In this sponsored interview, we talk with NK about her novel. NK, welcome to Fully Booked.
Thank you.
You're a mechanical engineer. How did you get interested in writing a novel based on your family's history?
Recently, you know, I just felt a need to do it. There's just a lot of confusion about where and what happened to the Mims family after the massacre. They know about the ones that died, but they didn't know what happened to the ones that lived. I just felt compelled to tell the story.
What surprising things did you learn while researching the story?
I learned that defenders of the fort weren't really capable of defending, or maybe they underestimated the Creeks so tragically that had so much to do with what happened.
Why did you decide to use Prudence Mims, a teenager, as the book's narrator?
Well, Prudence is my direct descendant. And she was one of the people that they didn't know. Historians didn't know where she was or how she escaped the massacre, for one thing. The second thing is that when I wrote the book, and I used her as a device like they do in Shakespeare, and like Shakespeare did, in that it was easy for her to be overlooked, and she could hear conversations around her and seem invisible. So it helped to bring the history in when she's overhearing conversations about it.
How did you make the transition from writing highly technical documents to crafting historical literature?
Well, it's not easy because they're two different animals. They're, you know, in technical documents, you write in third person passive, and in novels, you write creative, active voice. And, well, it took a lot of editing from Kirk's, thank goodness. So I appreciate all your help in helping me learn how to do it.
What is your next project?
Have a few little ideas about it, but right now I'm just trying to get this book off the ground and figure out how to market things. And I think it'll come to me if I very organically, the same way this book came to me.
NK, thanks for talking to us about your novel. If you're just joining the podcast, you can order NK Parton's Red Tears at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.